Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful handcrafted agricultural journal. Purchase a copy today at southernfarmandgarden.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, "We know how to cook, what can we do?" They said, "I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins," and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, hello. This is Kimberly Chow Tuanan. I am one of your hosts of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. It's a radio show on Heritage Radio Network where we talk about what we are reading, watching, and listening to with friends and family throughout the food and media worlds and beyond that. I'm also one of the co-directors of Food Book Fair. Food Book Fair is an annual, now biannual and bicoastal in New York and LA, festival of writing about eating. I'm thrilled to be in the booth, at least over the phone lines, with Nick Sharma, who's calling in today live. He is the writer, photographer, and recipe developer behind A Brown Table, an award-winning blog that has garnered best-ofs from Sever, Parade, Better Homes and Gardens, and more, and the International Association of Culinary Professions. His weekly column, A Brown Kitchen, appears in the San Francisco Chronicle. He is also the brand new author of a beautiful book that just came out last week called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. I'm really happy to bring him on just now. Nick, you on the line?
I am.
Hi Nick. Welcome. Hello. It's great to be on the phone with you. We saw each other at an event at the Museum of Food and Drink with you and Julian Tershin and Jari Magazine and Shannon Mustafer and a bunch of other great folks for Queer Soup Night last week in person in New York. Where are you calling from today?
I'm back home in Oakland.
Okay. Great. Thanks for adjusting for time difference and meeting me here in this proverbial booth. So we talked to we're going to get right into talking about your cookbook, but we'd love to sort of check in on what you're reading beyond the cookbook, what you're listening to, what you're watching. What's on your nightstand?
What's on my nightstand? Ottolenghi Simple, as of right now.
Okay. How do you read? Do you actually get in bed? And this is bedtime reading. I think we use the term sort of metaphorically, but a lot of people we do interview on the show, and there are a lot of cookbook people on the show and people that write them and people that love them. They love getting in bed with a cookbook, which I do too, I have to admit.
I do like to do that because it's a way for me to, since I'm, you know, I moved here when I was an adult, it's a great way for me to kind of find out what was going on previously. Mm-hmm. And so I actually enjoy reading either the books that are coming out. So Ottolenghi Simple just came out. But I also really like reading books that have been out of print for a really long time. So I kind of understand the history of the nation and the world from a Western view and a Western lens. Mm-hmm. And,
Typically, it's a book that's really old, and you'll find it sitting on my nightstand, sometimes even inside my sheets.
What else is on your nightstand? Is there anything of the historical, on the historical front, as you mentioned?
Sure. As of now, I'm reading Jane Grigson's Fruit book, which I've really like the way she kind of approaches ingredients. It's very fun. It's very casual. And that's one of the books that I was actually reading before Simple arrived.
Okay. And are you cooking from either one of these? Are they more source material, inspiration, kitchen inspiration?
Well, I haven't cooked from Fruit yet. I've marked out a couple of things that I want to. From Ottolenghi Simple, there are a couple of things that I really want to try out. But as of yet, I haven't cooked from either of those books because I've also been away on my book tour and I just got back.
Did you pick up any recommends on your book tour?
Yes, I did a lot, actually. And sometimes I feel it's going to be impossible to keep up with the books that are coming out. I just got a copy of, and this isn't new, it's been out for a few months, Chai, Chaat and Chutney by Chetna McCann from the UK. It's a beautiful book, and I'm waiting to dig in. And then I also picked up a copy of Gunpowder, which is another Indian restaurant in London. I was looking for books that I wouldn't be able to find else when I was in New York. I actually picked them up.
Where did you pick them up?
Both books were at, well, one was from the Kitchen Arts and Letters, and the second was actually through a and the second was through a friend who actually got a copy of Gunpowder and said I had to read it. So when I met up with him in New York, he gave me a copy.
Okay, cool. That's a great gift. Yeah. I love getting books from international presses, some of which we never see here. So that's
which is such a shame.
I know.
Yeah, because they're so beautiful, and it's a different, it's a whole different lens just to see how people approach the same culture, the same food in a different way. It's always fascinating.
Anything else that you're reading or watching or listening to that is non-food related?
Non-food related. Wow, that's...
if your life is 99% food related, that's also totally okay.
Okay. I know there's no shame there. I'm actually... I've been actually looking at how to plant bulbs for... I have a large garden, so I'm looking at how to plant bulbs for spring. That's something that I've been reading quite a lot. It seems to... There are a lot of people who have different opinions on when to plant crocus and... daffodils and all those other plants. So I'm trying to like plan that out. So I've actually been doing a lot of mapping things out right now for the garden.
What are you going to plant? What's in your your vision?
So I kind of want the garden to be a little colorful this year in spring. So I've picked up a couple of, like I said, daffodils. We've got a couple of crocus from where saffron comes. We've also picked up a bunch of hyacinths. I really love the fragrance of hyacinth. And I picked some of those up. So I just need to space them out properly and make sure they don't rot because we get rain in December. So I just need to make sure they make it through.
What is the advice for planting bulbs in Oakland?
Well, so luckily...
Something about frost, right?
Yeah, so we don't really get frost. But when it rains, I think that's probably my biggest concern because that's when the slugs will probably get in and start to chew away on the bulbs. I'm also not the type that of a person that will take things out every year and put them back in. I don't have the capacity or the bandwidth to do that, and I will never keep up. So I'm just hoping that they go into the ground and they keep coming back every year and multiplying.
My fingers are crossed for you. I'm wishing you good bulb luck, which I guess you'll find out in the springtime what happens.
I will, yeah, hopefully.
Cool. It sounds like you've got a lot on your plate, food-wise as well as non-food-wise. For me, I am reading The Joy Luck Club again because... I love The Joy Luck Club. I'm seeing if I can squeeze in a viewing of the movie. I've been watching YouTube clips because Food Book Fair is co-hosting an event tomorrow night at Neighborhood Studio with Peddler Journal. okay. which is an amazing independent magazine. They have a new issue called that the theme is rice. So we're going to serve a bunch of rice-centric dishes, and we're going to host a okay. talk about Joy okay. Luck Club with the fashion scholar and a dear friend, Kimberly Jenkins, and Hetty McKinnon, who is the founder of Peddler Journal. And we're going to talk about fashioning the self, and we're going to talk about food and symbolism and mother-daughter intergenerational trauma and bad boyfriends and husbands and mahjong and eat Chinese food. I wish you could join for that. I feel like you would really enjoy it.
That is actually one of the first movies I got introduced to when I moved to grad school in Cincinnati. One of my professors, mm-hmm. who's Chinese, he's American Chinese, and introduced me to that movie and said, you need to watch this. And he actually lent his DVD back when we used to use DVDs. And that's when I first got to see the movie and then eventually read the book. It was beautiful.
Do you remember much of the movie? I think there are some discrepancies between the book and the movie, and I need to watch to see what those are. I also understand the movie okay. is more than 3 hours long.
It is long, but I mean, you don't really feel it because you're looking at all the food and also kind of looking at the dynamics of the relationships mm-hmm. between everyone and the woman. Mm-hmm. It's been a while, but I think from what I vividly remember is the way the food was presented. Everything was very family style. It was also very without the frou-frou, the non-pretentious mm-hmm. way like food is sometimes presented, and it felt more comfortable mm-hmm. than a lot of the others. It felt more inviting is mm-hmm. probably a better word than compared to a lot of the other food related movies that focus too much on chefs. Mm-hmm. They just, I feel like, geared towards different audiences. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I just found it much more emotional when I saw that kind of style of presentation.
I would love to find out who was the food stylist on that film, if they had one, and how that worked and what that experience was like. And I mean, that was such a 25 years ago, almost 26 years ago now movie was made. And I think folks' interest in food is part of popular culture and how we talk about it. And also how, quote unquote, you know, non-Western foods have been centered in American popular culture in a different way, how that's really changed. I'd be really curious about that. Maybe after this event, that'll be my like casual thesis project.
Yeah. That'll be actually a good project to explore.
Yeah. Well, I love how, I want to talk a little bit more about that, the emotional quality and the intimacy of how you portray your work, especially, in the cookbook and in your column and on the blog. So I'd love to get into that in a little bit, but first we're going to take a short commercial break.
Okay.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit radio network. Oh, hello. Hello. That was the break music, but I'm going to do the spiel anyway. Heritage Radio Network is an amazing nonprofit radio network. It produces this show and many others all about food and drink and the world around it. Please support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. We need your support to keep our voices and our programming on air. We appreciate it. Nick, I'll be right back with you in a little bit.
Sounds good.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful, handcrafted agricultural journal. Each issue features stories about food history, seasonal recipes, artisanal products, and the amazing people who bring it to your table. Packed with stunning photography, the content is fresh and educational. Southern Farm and Garden takes you behind the scenes to meet farmers, gardeners, wineries, chefs, and artists who are passionate about creating healthy, unique, and sustainable food and products that you can enjoy all year. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Purchase a copy today at southernfarmandgarden.com. Foodtank.com named Southern Farm and Garden one of the top 20 magazines for people who eat, cook, and grow, praising it for connecting readers with the food, the farms, and the stories behind our food system. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at southernfarmandgarden.com.
Hello, hello. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm Kimberly Chow Tsuanan. I'm one of your co-hosts, and I'm also one of the co-directors of Food Book Fair, a biannual bi-coastal festival of writing about eating. We talk about on the show what we're watching, what we're listening to, and what we're reading with our friends and family in and around the worlds of food and media. I'm on the air today with Nick Sharma, who is the blogger and photographer behind A Brown Table, the columnist behind San Francisco Chronicle's A Brown Kitchen, and the newly minted author of Season. Nick, welcome back.
Thank you, Kim. It's good to be here today.
Really happy to have you calling in all the way live from Oakland, California. Would love to talk to you more about this book. Congratulations. I really, really love at the beginning, the intro, how there's a very sweet foreword by John Birdsall, and it talks about his first experience seeing your work and seeing specifically how the intimacy of your work and also just the surprise and the beauty of seeing brown hands, non-white hands in photographs, and reading about your experience and how your different identities and stories and background of coming from India to the United States to the Midwest and then California, being married to a Southerner, how that came through into your work. Can you, I know this is now not a question, but a really leading multi-part comment, but can we talk a little bit about how you started conceiving how to tell your story first as the blog developed and as your column developed and how it became the book as it looks now?
Sure. So I've always had no other story to tell except my own story. And what I wrote was from my heart. This was my experience. This is how I feel. This is what happened to me and how it shaped my life. And so I felt with the book, with the column, and with the blog, these were parts of me that I wanted to share with people. Mm-hmm. And I think they're obviously different formats. They reach different groups of people. But I felt I had to do it because this was also the way that I learned how to cook. I was being exposed to different elements in my life. Living in India, I was exposed to a whole different set of food. My mom's from the West Coast, and she's Roman Catholic and grew up, her family well is from a Portuguese colony called Goa. And so I was exposed to that kind of a food or cuisine where it was heavily influenced by the West, but it was also Indian in its own way. And then my dad's family's from the North, and he's Hindu, a conservative Brahmin family. And so their food was mostly vegetarian. And so these elements were a part of my life as I grew up. And it started to shape the way I started to think about food. And then when I moved to America, the same thing. You know, I was in a new country, and America has people from all over the world. And even living in Ohio, I was being exposed to that once again. And so then I moved across the country to D.C. You know, my husband's from the South, and then California. And so as I lived along the way, it was natural for these things to become a part of my life. And I wanted to have fun with it. I wanted to explore it because that was my way to the world. And, you know, it only made sense for me to talk when I was writing the book. When I talk about a recipe, I always like to kind of give the story behind and also kind of the reasoning behind why I did what I did, so people kind of understand where I'm coming from and it's not a random thought.
What would you say, can you talk a little bit about the evolution of the blog to the column to the book?
Yeah. So I started out blogging because I was so heavily sunk into academia. I was living in D.C. I was working as a researcher during the day.
Oh, right. We should research. tell our listeners who don't know of your secret past life.
I used to be a geneticist in a previous life, studying biochemistry and genetics. And that is what I was doing at Georgetown in D.C. And then I also decided I would go back to school because I was living in D.C. and I kind of envisioned that I would end up in some form of political life. And that's, I think, what happens when you live in D.C. So I went and got a degree in the evening in public policy from Georgetown, which was probably a crazy idea. So I did that. But at the time, I was so engrossed in academia that I needed a creative outlet. And ever since I moved to America, I was entertaining friends who wanted to kind of explore Indian food, and also it was giving me an opportunity to do it in my own way. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of my friends suggested, why don't you write a food blog? And that's how the blog began.
Mm-hmm.
It was until I moved to California when I quit my job. That's when the blog kind of became a full-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also quit my job to work as a pastry cook because I kind of wanted to explore and see if I really wanted to go to culinary school or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked as a pastry cook for a while, for about a year and a half in Santa Clara in South Bay. And then I got a job in San Francisco as a food photographer because I had, at this point, I had started to do work in print. Mm-hmm. And worked there for a year, but I really wasn't happy with my life because I was also photographing everyone else's food but not getting a chance to share my food,
mm-hmm.
which is hard because I think sometimes in the business, people want you to choose one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never wanted to separate either. So I do not want to separate being a writer, a photographer, or a cook from what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for freelance photography jobs at the time, which is when I got introduced to my editor at the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, Paolo Lucchesi. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, can I, I'm looking for freelance photography jobs. Do you have something in mind? You know, here's my portfolio. And so he said, okay, I'll get back to you. And after 2 weeks, he got back to me and said, hey, we're actually wondering if you would be interested in writing your own food column. And that's how my food column was born,
mm-hmm.
At the Chronicle. So it was, everything was kind of unintentional, but it kind of fell into place, which is, I'm really lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is how all of these elements came about in my life.
Can we talk about the names A Brown Table and A Brown Kitchen?
Of course. So A Brown Table. A Brown Table is obviously a play of my hands, but it's also very literal because when I started to photograph, I had two planks of wood from my now husband's farm. His parents live on a farm out in Virginia, North Carolina, right in the border. And so I would bring back parts of vintage wood because that used to be the, I guess, the most popular backdrop for food photography at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get these planks of wood and I would put them, balance them on the regular trash can and then on our recycle,
mm-hmm.
and photograph. And that's when I said, ooh, you know, let's call it A Brown Table. And then A Brown Kitchen was kind of a spin-off of my column.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of made sense to you kind of just tie it in together.
Mm-hmm. I like the play on words there, of hands and then also the table. Was that, and I would love to, I know this is like a nuanced and longer conversation, but
mm-hmm.
you've talked a lot about your story as someone who is bicultural with parents with different backgrounds and then also someone who is sort of a multi-world from Asia to America kind of person who's mm-hmm. also an immigrant, who's also queer,
mm-hmm.
And identifies as a queer brown person. Can you tell me and talk a little bit about what that's like for you to make that part of your work? Because I think for a lot of us right now, and I'm speaking as a person of color who's in solidarity with other person of people of color and queer people,
sure.
trying to make and take space in the food world, I think we're trying to figure out what it's like to lead with our identities and make space for others by doing that, but also what it's like when we're doing that kind of work while engaging with other people, mm-hmm. mainstream white folks.
Yeah, I think I could never, one of the things I realized when I was getting into this world of food media, and this was eventually over the couple of years,
mm-hmm.
Was that I had to realize that I couldn't really separate myself from either identities.
Yeah.
They are a part of me, but they also should not define me completely.
Yeah.
And so I think that is the biggest challenge that I have faced as a writer, a photographer, and a cook, is how do I bring everything together and share it with people so people are comfortable. I want people to be comfortable having conversations that would otherwise make them uncomfortable. And one of the things that I find the best way to do that is to be vulnerable and tell them about my experiences. Hopefully they identify with that. And then it gives them room to, you know, share their stories. And so we can have a dialogue,
mm-hmm.
Because that's really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think So coming into the food world, I think it was, I couldn't separate like my skin color from me. Obviously, my sexuality is a part of me. And I also, as a writer, as I've matured over the past couple of years, I've really been interested in the history of food and culture and how that intersects with present days. And that would obviously come from my perspective as to how I'm experiencing it. Because there's obviously like great positive history in food, but there's also a lot of negative past. And I think it's okay to address that and, you know, talk about these challenges that exist and instead of sweeping them under the rug. So I've been very forthcoming in how I feel. And I think largely the reception has been positive, which is amazing. But I think that's how I felt was, it came natural to me. And it was also for me, I felt the best way to approach this.
Can you talk a little bit more about how, what that process has been like for you to engage with these deeper conversations and harder questions within the context of your work? Has that evolved over time? Also, as the world around us has evolved over time, or at least sort of the outward-facing world with this current administration, et cetera, have, how we've broken the planet, et cetera, et cetera.
It's hard. I'm not going to like paint a rosy picture and say it's easy. And I think one of the challenges for me, every time I open a little bit of myself up to the world, I am making myself extremely vulnerable to comments from people. And I did experience that when I, you know, started to, you know, I photographed myself in my food from an instructional standpoint, but also because I want to kind of give a voice to people who work in kitchens. Having worked with them, we come from different parts of life, you know, rich for different countries, health issues. And so I kind of wanted to do that through my photos because you'll never see them in front of a kitchen. And so I started to do that with my photos. And initially I did get comments about the color of my skin being too dark, too ashy. And, you know, I went through that. But every time I share a little bit of myself, I am making myself vulnerable. But at the same time, it's important for me to do that because I find it important because I always think about the kid or, you know, the little boy, the little girl that's out there questioning themselves whether they have a place in this society of food. And I'm talking just in general about food society because that's what I'm most familiar with. I can't speak for the rest. But it's really important for me to not I don't want to be a role model. I don't think that's something that I've ever, you know, I want to even be classified into because I feel role models are like, everyone thinks that I'm perfect and I'm not. But at the same time, I kind of want people to be able to identify, see that you have a future. You have a, you know, there are possibilities for you. You have a lot of potential to do good in the food world and share your stories. And so hopefully like my sharing my experiences, you don't have to then do the same, make the same mistake that I did. And it acts as somewhat of a guide for you to have a amazing career, hopefully.
Have you ever, have you gotten any positive reader feedback, folks that are grateful
I
for
have.
Making space? And what,
I have.
What has that been like?
Well, so a couple of years ago, for the when I started writing for the Chronicle, the newspaper, it opened me up to a whole new world of people. So, and I've written some very, I've kind of revisited a couple of dark moments in my life from most recently, the story that I wrote was about in India, about them knocking, decriminalizing homosexuality. And so I just shared my experience as to why I left India, you know, because I was, I knew I was gay as a child and I knew it was not a safe place for me to grow up. So I had to get out. So I shared my experience about that. And it was amazing just to see the positive reception from people who were Indian and were gay and had gone through the same story. And had moved away or, you know, had a really hard time. Even with the book, the reception has been phenomenal because, you know, I'm connecting with people who are not only Indian, but also who are from Asia, who are people of color, and who are queer, just saying, hey, thank you for writing this because this is what I went through. And, you know, I feel I'm not alone. And for me, that's the biggest thing because even when I was coming out, I honestly had not read or heard of anyone like me. And just to have like a, you know, another point of view. Mm-hmm. It's such an amazing thing to have. And that is something that I always feel I missed out as a child.
Because
you don't know what the future holds for you. But having someone share that experience is such a powerful tool.
Can I ask some of the folks that you looked up to or books or other sources of inspiration then that gave you inspiration and light and buoyed you even not, you know, through or despite hard times, but if, and I think this is one of the incredible things now with access to social media and the internet, et cetera, and the way that information travels is that young folks or anybody of any age, anywhere, if they have access, and I want to say this understanding that not everybody has access to, for different reasons, but having access to this information and seeing examples of ourselves modeled, whether in books, online, et cetera, is incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. So what were, as you were growing up and even, I mean, we're still as adults, we're still growing. Who are folks that you have or currently still look up to or presented as models for ways to live or ways to build a career and be?
Yeah, definitely Julia Tertian. I think Julia Tertian is quite, she's kind of like a pillar in the community, in the food community for you know Julia well too. And she also puts herself out there to kind of represent and spread the word that, hey, you're not alone. And there are people like you and me. And let's connect. Let's talk. You know, another writer that I really love is John Birdsall.
Mm-hmm.
He's done so much wonderful work as a food writer, and he is focused on the intersection of gay culture and food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his work is amazing. He's also been an amazing mentor and supporter of my work. And then there are people like, Mother Joffrey, who kind of sets the stage for writers like me early on, because, you know, the path to progress, I feel, is always long. And I feel even where I'm at right now, I'm really thankful to people and authors like Mother Joffrey, Nilufar Kapuria King, who kind of set the stage for Indian food to be recognized as something to have a, you know, have a place on a national, I mean, on an international stage. And that's not an easy thing to sell to a different part of the world.
Yeah.
And they've done that most eloquently. And so I'm very grateful to writers like them who have kind of set the stage for, you know, all the different generations of writers to come.
Well, I want to ask in follow-up then, who is on the come up or who hasn't gotten as much shine that you want to put on, or people that you think are next up, that whether they are making Indian food, whether they're queer, folks of color, whatever, folks that are deserving of more attention and you're excited to see their work develop?
Yeah, I think one of the books that I know it was a Beard-nominated book, but I wish it got a lot more attention, was My Two Selves by Asha Gomes.
Yes.
And I feel that is such a powerful book. It speaks to me right down through the bones of my soul. She and I love her, and, you know, her food's amazing. But the book is also the story of an immigrant, essentially. Asha is telling her story through food. She's a single mom. She's a champion of, you know, human rights. She does so much work that people don't recognize and don't know about. And I feel she definitely deserves a lot more attention than she has received. And I hope she does.
Asha, we see you. Book. We appreciate you. Do you guys, have you cooked together?
So we've never met.
Okay.
We've communicated a lot. She's written a blurb for my book. But there was a time when I asked a question about chili powders, and Asha said, hold on, let me send you some. And ever since then, I fell in love with her.
That's a really good internet meet cute. I like that.
Yeah. but, I mean, she's very generous with the time. She, you know, there are people that take the time who are very successful, take the time to open a book or respond to a question by a relatively unknown voice like mine, you know. And those are the people that I love and I appreciate so much because they're busy, mm-hmm. but they actually take the time to write a blurb or even a few words about your book. It's, to someone like me, that means the world because you feel like you fit in.
Yeah, I love that. I hope you all get to meet soon. So listeners who don't know, Asha is an incredible Indian-American chef who lives in the South. Perhaps you know her book, My Tooth Souths, or you've seen her on Ugly Delicious in the fried chicken episode. Which watching her make fried chicken and talk about it and host just made me really want to be part of her kitchen. Yeah. So I hope we all get that chicken experience with her in the future.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your Southern / Indian recipes, speaking of?
Yeah, of course. I think we can start with the fried chicken and the buckwheat.
Let's do it.
Chicken. since we're on this fried chicken cake. My husband's from the South. And one of the things that he truly loves is biscuits. There's a dish called scrapple that is, I don't think a lot of people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a sausage meets Spam.
Okay.
It's fatty and greasy and it's good and it's spiced well and it's delicious. It's something that you, I know his my mother-in-law cooks it on a cast iron pan and then serves it with eggs and for breakfast dish typically. And another thing he really loves is fried chicken. So I did in the book a curry leaf popcorn chicken, which was kind of my own. It's playful because it's popcorn. It makes you feel less guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like it's Indian, but it's not Indian. Southern American, but it's really not. It's just it meets you in between, halfway through. And that is one of my odes to him. Mm-hmm. Another dish that I put in the book for kind of towards the South is his family really loves egg salad and chicken salad. So I included a couple of those in the book and gave it my own spin.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is deviled eggs. The deviled eggs, I drew inspiration from a lot of the Middle Eastern elements that I've eaten in restaurants out here.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a little bit of tahini, a little bit of yogurt in it to kind of make the yolk filling much lighter and also add flavor. And so that is something that now we serve in the house when we visit them in Virginia.
I love that. I love that exchange. I also want to say I'm, as a Taiwanese person, part of my culture is popcorn chicken, which is sold as street food. So partly that's why your recipe really spoke to me when I saw that. And we do either popcorn chicken or you can also do it with calamari and you serve it with fried basil leaves or cilantro. So seeing the fried curry leaf, I was like, I see this analog. I appreciate that.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Popcorn chicken is a delicious intercultural thing. I think it's hard not to love.
It's also guilt-free.
I mean, I want to say that there's no such thing as food guilt, but I know it exists. And I also know if I eat a lot of fried chicken, I don't feel great. But yet, it's delicious. It's delicious.
I know. The only sad part about making something like that is you have to share it.
Yeah, true. So what are some of the things beyond popcorn chicken that if you are hosting from this book and cooking with folks that you would that you would put together as a menu to share? And I know there are probably many options, but what are you sort of vibing on or what are some recent recommendations to folks?
Now we're kind of entering into fall season and we're getting closer towards Thanksgiving. One of the things I strongly recommend is taking the hot green chutney from the cookbook, which is basically a recipe that I designed to utilize the leftover arugula and kale leaves in my refrigerator. I buy a lot of salad greens and then I typically end up with a cup of this, a cup of that. And I said, you know what? I'm so sick of eating salad now. Can I make this into a condiment and something that stretches out?
Mm-hmm.
So I made the hot green chutney using those greens. Not only can you use it in chicken like I've done in the book, it's also a really great way if you can scale it up and put it into a turkey. And stick it into the oven because it's an amazing condiment, but just by itself, you can eat it as is, use it as a dipping sauce.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stick it between the flesh and the skin, season the outer skin with a bit of salt and a little bit of olive oil, stick it into the oven,
you'll be very happy.
That sounds great.
Another dish that I recommend if you don't feel like going through the work of making a pie is to make the sweet potato babinka in the book. Babinka is a dish that was brought by the Portuguese to Asia, and so you'll see it in Goan food, which is where my mom's from, mm-hmm. and you'll also hear about it in Filipino food. Mm-hmm. They're all slightly different, and this is the easier one where it's called mock babinka. Basically, it's sweet potatoes, coconut milk, eggs, a little bit of flour. You don't need a crust of any kind. You just pour everything, bake it, and let it sit overnight, unmold the next day, and serve it. Mm. And it's delicious. It's got a little bit of maple syrup, a little bit of nutmeg to kind of play on the fall flavors. I strongly recommend that. You could also do, if you're vegan, you could try the butternut squash tea soup, where the tea leaves kind of give an umami touch to the whole soup. Mm-hmm. And you don't need, obviously, bones for that, meat bones for that. Another thing is, a good side is the Brussels sprouts that are cooked with poppy seeds and a little bit of coconut oil. And most of these ingredients you actually have in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So it's not something new. Mm-hmm. It's just using them in a different, unexpected way, as I've done in the book. And you could also do, if you can get your hands, I know mango isn't really in season, but the color works beautifully in fall, is if you can get your hands on canned mangoes from India, make the spiced mango milkshake in the book. Mm-hmm. I could have mangoes all year round.
I loved your column where you were talking about that?
Yeah, I'm obsessed with canned mangoes.
And I was like, oh, I don't know about this. And it was like, you have to get this kind of mango, and you can get this maybe sometimes. And
I know. I'm very particular. I'm a little snobbish about my mangoes. I have to get them from India, otherwise I don't eat them. And because it's so hard to find, I just get the canned mangoes from the Indian store. And you now get them organic and without added sugar. So it's like a real deal. It's not a question anymore.
What brand, okay, for our listeners out there, to get as close as possible but in a can experience, what should they be looking for? Is there a specific brand for these mangoes?
There are a couple, but if you go to an Indian store now, I think Deep might have them. There's an organic, no sugar variety. And if I'm correct, there's one with a number. I think it's called 24.
Okay.
I'll need to check it. But yeah, I mean, just ask your Indian grocery store, and they'll be more than happy to tell you what to do.
Okay, that sounds great. For the milkshake, I'll keep that in mind. Is there anything else that you really love, a food item, a spice that you miss that you can't get here, or something that you can get here but miss when you're in India, or vice versa?
One of the spices that I feel we don't get in India is, and that I miss when I'm traveling to India, is orange blossom water.
Whoa.
It's typically seen in Middle Eastern cooking, and I love it. Mm-hmm. And I used it in the book too. I wish it becomes an ingredient that's more readily available out there. Mm-hmm. But typically in Indian cooking, you'll see rose water, which is what the Mughals brought to India when they conquered the country. Mm-hmm. An ingredient that I wish we would see more of here, and we do, and I try to represent it in the book, is curry leaves. I kind of want everyone to have access to curry leaves, because dried curry leaves aren't as great, but the fresh is where the action is, and that's what, like, you know, brings this unique flavor palette to a dish, and it's so powerful.
This is making me hungry. I am excited to, maybe I'll make some of these recipes for dinner afterwards.
Sweet.
Thank you so much for calling in. It's been so nice to get to chat about the book, and I would love to talk a little bit about what's up next for you. I know you're on book tour.
I'm on book tour till December. What's up for me? You know, just writing for my column at the Chronicle, writing more, and we'll see where things take me. I have no idea what's going to happen in the next few months.
In the meantime, I hope folks across the country, when you're on tour, they can come find you and find Season the Cookbook. You can find it #SeasonCookbook. You can find Nick on social media platforms at A Brown Table. Is that correct? And anywhere, is there anywhere
that
else we should point folks towards?
Go to my blog, A Brown Table, and look, if you look under the book, you'll see events. And, you know, I'll be traveling across the country as well as I'll be traveling internationally this year. So come out and say hi.
Come out and say hi. Bring him, give him some recommendations for other international books, and let us know your mango thoughts for folks that are listening. Nick,
yeah.
thank you so much. I'm going to call the Indian store now and find out what my mango can options are.
Yes, you should, and let me know if you have a problem.
I will. You'll be the first person I call. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you again in New York or in Oakland or elsewhere very soon.
Yes, likewise. Thanks, Kim.
Talk soon. And folks, this is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm one of your hosts, Kimberly Chow, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.